Hello and welcome to Nerdzilla, the podcast in memory of all those people who've been eaten by zombies,
sucked dry by vampires,
implanted with eggs by an alien species,
attacked by an oversized fish,
absorbed by a gelatinous blob,
or horribly murdered because they went back in the spooky house to look for the cat. This episode, our Geek of the Week, we are just so not worthy of being in his presence.
He is nerd to the power of nerd. We are talking to comic book writer, best-selling author, screenwriter, Neil Gaiman.
I'm going to be reviewing a movie that's probably not quite as good as Neil Gaiman's work. That's The Phantom, the new version of The Phantom as put together by the Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, come on, it was awesome. And in the flame war, we go Bill Gates versus Steve Jobs. Yes, PC versus Mac.
But first, the news.
Warner Brothers have just announced that Anne Hathaway has been cast in Christopher Nolan's much-anticipated next Batman film, The Dark Knight Rises. They also confirmed that the excellent Tom Hardy will play supervillain Bane. Now, while plenty of websites are stating that Hathaway will play Catwoman, as ABC News Online have pointed out, the Warner press release makes mention only of her character, Selina Kyle.
The one thing I found funny about the mentions of the new Batman movie is they're calling it TDKR. And when I first saw that, I went, The Dark Knight Returns? They're making a movie of The Dark Knight Returns? You know, I went into a geek frenzy at that, and then, it's The Dark Knight Rises. Yeah, I knew there was a third Batman movie, and I am looking forward to it, but it's The Dark Knight Returns.
Do you think every time Frank Miller reads it, he gets really excited and then goes, no?
To some more marvellous news, some photos have turned up from the set of X-Men First Class, a movie which is set back in the 1960s when Magneto and Charles Xavier are young men. You know, it's funny, pretty much everyone in this shot of the cast is wearing a classic X-Men style battle suit, except Emma Frost, who's wearing a bikini with a mink style across her shoulders. But I did just find out that Kevin Bacon is playing Sebastian Shaw, so I'm actually becoming a little more keen to see this one.
Despite Apple's attempts to keep the iPad free of filth, and therefore make it completely different to the rest of the internet, an app for browsing issues of Playboy might be available this year. And the best part? The source of this information was a tweet from none other than Hugh Hefner himself. But Gizmodo have just reported that Hef may not have actually been referring to an app, but to a website optimised for the iPad. I'm just loving the mental image of Hef in pyjamas and a smoking jacket just tweeting himself silly.
Did you see any of Ricky Gervais's gags from the Golden Globe Awards that he was presenting recently?
Certainly did.
His joke about Hugh Hefner, if you haven't seen it, is totally worth having a look at. Some bad news for people like us now. According to this new article in a medical journal, if you spend 4 hours per day or more sitting still in front of a screen, you are twice as likely to die of a heart attack. And the kicker is, exercise at other times doesn't seem to make a difference. Apparently, sitting perfectly still for such a long period changes your blood chemistry. It affects the amount of fat hanging around in your blood. So you can hit the gym all you want, but it's that sitting still in front of a screen watching the TV or a computer that's going to kill you in the end.
The Nintendo 3DS, the new handheld gaming device that lets you watch movies and play games in 3D without dopey-looking glasses on, now has a release date of March 27th and a recommended retail price of $249 US. As well as 3D, the unit will apparently have motion and gyro sensors and will be able to take 3D pictures, however that works. Oh, and it will apparently come in either blue or black, like Batman costumes.
I quite like the fact that it has a little camera looking out from the machine to the person using the machine, and it has facial recognition software to the point where it can recognise who's playing it. So if you play one of the social games like Nintendogs, where you have to sort of bring up a dog from a puppy, if you have treated the dog cruelly, it will remember that. If you've been nice to the dog, it will remember that. Hopefully, though, Zelda won't remember that you killed them 50 or 60 times the previous day when you were playing. Just as the new game DC Universe Online is launching, Champions Online is also about to kick off. Andrew, you might remember Champions, the tabletop superhero role-playing game.
It was fantastic. I've still got the Champions rulebook.
And it was sort of generic. It had its own universe that wasn't based in a comic or a movie or anything like that. It was all out of the game. Well, they've made it into an MMORPG. Again, very similar to the DC Universe Online. The difference is, from what I can see, is that Champions is free. It's free to download, free to install, free to play. You only pay when you want extra stuff. So if you want a cooler costume, or if you want a character with extra arms or something like that, you actually have to go to a little store and pay for those sorts of things. You can even buy a retcon, so you can change your character's power set.
True comic book style.
And considering that DCU Online, I just saw it in a shop here, is $99 for the PS3 game, plus you end up paying about $15 a month to continue to be able to play multiplayer world. This is so much cheaper, and it launches in late January 2011, only about a fortnight after DC Universe does.
And of course, what we all did when playing Champions back in the old days was everybody would simply roll up a character that looked suspiciously like a superhero from a comic book.
How many Wolverine knockoffs were wandering around that universe, I wonder?
There was a hell of a lot of Batmans and people from other planets who could fly. In what is disappointing news for me, at least, DC Comics have pushed back issue number one of the new Batwoman comic to April. The character of Kate Kane, who I really enjoy, her Batwoman was first introduced in 2006, and her own series suffered so many setbacks that eventually in 2009 the stories were all published as a story arc in Detective Comics, which was convenient since Bruce Wayne was just dead then, sort of, and they didn't have much else to write about. In related news, the original writer Greg Rucka has left DC Comics completely, but his collaborator J.H. Williams will continue writing the character. Now, whether this has anything to do with the delay is anybody's guess.
And Segways have been banned from UK sidewalks after a judge decided that they were effectively vehicles and therefore not appropriate for the sidewalk. But I reckon if they really want people to stop using them, just make people watch the YouTube video Face, the montage of epic face plants. About a minute or so into that, you see a woman going at top speed on a Segway one moment, and then, ba-bam, she's down and kissing the pavement. I saw that, and I don't think I'll ever step on a Segway again.
You've got to say, for a compilation of face plants, the Segway one wins.
You're listening to Nerdzilla.
Nerdzilla is recorded in Hobart, and we're lucky enough occasionally that the good stuff comes to us. We don't have to go to the good stuff. And tweeting furiously in the studio with us today is Neil Gaiman. Neil, how are you doing today?
I'm having a wonderful day. All I have to do is this, and then my honeymoon starts. So I get 2 days of actual honeymoon.
You're in Hobart for Mona FOMA, which is the Museum of Old and New Art Festival of Music and Art.
I never knew all this time.
We Tasmanians just call MOFO. Now, you read a story the other night accompanied by a string quartet while paintings were displayed. How did that come about?
It came about because last year there was a glorious festival called Graphic at Sydney Opera House. And one of the organizers, one of the secret brains behind the Graphic Festival, is a man called Jordan Verzar, who works with Foreplay, the aforementioned string quartet. And Graphic asked if I would come as, you know, an inaugural guest for the festival, which I thought would be enormously fun. I said yes. And then Jordan made this very odd suggestion. He said, what about if you read a story accompanied by a string quartet, and maybe we could get an artist to do some paintings? And I just finished the story called The Truth is a Cave in the Black Mountains, which I knew was about 70 minutes long to read, and I knew might actually work. And I thought, well, hang on, my friend Eddie Campbell, who is probably most famous for From Hell, but also for the Alec comics, is a Scottish artist who's lived in Brisbane for the last 20-something years. So you have that nice Australian connection and the nice Scottish connection for a kind of Scottish short story, so he would know what the art looks like. And I said, well, this story, which nobody's heard, nobody had read. It was unpublished at that point. So Foreplay went off. They made some music. They sent it to me. I sent them notes back, then went out to Sydney, did a couple of days both rehearsing and figuring out how it worked. There were some places where the music they'd come up with for a section didn't work with that section, so we'd have to rethink it. And
there's also places where the timing is really important.
I had to learn. I had to learn when to shut up. I had to learn when to make sure that it was like, okay, here, you hold until we come in and stuff. And I did it incredibly nervously. Jordan points to the interviews that Eddie and I gave to important newspapers like The Australian before the Graphic Festival, before we did this because they're saying, well, what do you think it's going to be like? And I'm going, I have absolutely no idea. It could be a huge disaster. This may be terrible. And then they said to Eddie, you know, what do you think about this? And he's saying, ah, it's a stupid idea. What? But we sold out the Sydney Opera House and we got a standing ovation at the end. And people walked away going, I've never seen anything like it. It was like you're there for 70 minutes and you're making a movie in your head. And it's magic. So we knew we'd done something special. And when we were invited to Mona Foma, to MOFO, the idea of doing it again, we'd never, the idea of taking the show on the road or doing it anywhere else hadn't even occurred to us. But Eddie had come away from Sydney going, you know, I should have done a few more paintings. There were paintings, there were places it would have been really good to do some paintings. And we didn't have a recording of it. The Sydney Opera House recording was missing 20 seconds in the middle and wasn't very well mixed and stuff. So we thought it would be nice to have a live recording and it would be nice to see each other again because I really got on with the Foreplay guys. I think they're amazing. And that, combined with the fact that I was now, at the time, getting married to somebody who thinks that she has found paradise on Earth and it is Antipodean, and in fact was about to release her own album of which is just her giant ode to this part of the world. Also, the weird, wonderful goofiness of the fact that when Amanda was putting together her last Australian tour, I said, you have to go to Hobart. You'll love it there and they'll appreciate you and it'll be great. So she'd included Tasmania on the tour. And then as part of that, almost as a joke, because she'd done a beautiful song called Australia for Australia and she'd gone off to New Zealand and done this sort of slightly jokier song called New Zealand. A slightly jokier country. Actually, her New Zealand song is all about how grumpy she is about being in New Zealand. Then she came to Tasmania and heard the phrase Map of Tasmania and decided to write a funny song, which literally in 10 minutes, this little joke song about a map of Tasmania, which she figured would be, she'd sing it once here in Hobart and that would be that. Little did she know that some people would do a remix when she did this Down Under album, which she didn't know at that point, and it would wind up, Map of Tasmania would wind up being the first single off Amanda Palmer Goes Down Under. So here she is with an album and a single, and bring us back to where we started, of course. We got to say, let's do the festival together. And now we actually extended our stay, partly so we can see Nick Cave.
Go see Grinderman.
Yep.
But partly so we could grab a couple of days when nipping off to a cottage and just honeymooning.
Lovely.
I'm really looking forward to that bit.
Neil, we do have to wrap it up. Just a couple of very quick things, if we may. One is you did send out a tweet trying to find out who is the artist who did Andrew's tie. And I'm wondering if you've had any answers on the... there's actually a hashtag for it?
There is a hashtag for it, which is Nerdzilla Bat Tie. So
how are we looking?
We're not looking good, mostly because we apparently don't have any reception.
It's the dead room. We forgot about that.
Of course, yes. This is the dead room.
We'll find out when we walk out of the dead room.
So when we walk out, we will find out, and it's the kind of wonderfully glorious, goofy thing that you can stick up on your website. You must have a website.
Oh, clearly.
That we do.
So we can at least put that up.
But I should point out, I mean, who drew Batman on my tie is probably the most important issue that we've ever dealt with on the
Zoom. And it's a very problematic tie. I think it's probably a Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, yeah. I think. But using a sort of a Neil Adamsy, Jim Aparo-y model of what kind of Batman he's drawing. But it's something very odd about
it's on a tie. Maybe that's the odd part.
You don't see a lot of bat ties.
No, I've only got 16 of them.
How? Was this some kind of horrible obsession?
Why?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have other ties?
Have you seen his wedding ring?
Oh, it's a Batman.
Yeah, and bat cufflinks.
I'll have to keep the shirt on. Isn't that normal?
Our final thing is we figured, you know, you're here, you've just got married, you're on your honeymoon, we should give you a wedding present. And so
I believe Oh God is the correct thing to say.
We've bought you something very Tasmanian. They're aromatherapy lavender socks for the trip home on the plane or for lounging around in your cottage and some lavender oil, Tasmanian lavender oil, to refill them. We figure that, you know, your wife comes home from rocking out, it's relaxing for her and also subtly distinctifying.
I know, I love that. And also, of course, I was told by people that I would have lots of socks on my honeymoon and... I think that was what they were saying.
And that's what they meant.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Pleasant smelling socks.
Aromatherapy massage socks.
Well, we hope you enjoy them.
I think I will get as much joy out of these socks as it's humanly possible to do.
I'm glad they're aromatherapy ones in that case.
Exactly. And of course, you know, if I do go mad and wear them on the plane going back, I will report back to Nerdzilla on what the reaction of the people around me is to the socks.
Please, tweet us in. We'd like to know.
I'll tweet from the plane.
Neil Gaiman, thank you so much for being on Nerdzilla.
Thank you, guys. See you in another 6 years or whatever it's going
to
be.
We'll talk to you then.
Now, during that interview, Neil Gaiman did, in fact, tweet about Andrew Hogan's Batman tie, or the Batman tie he happened to be wearing that day.
Yes.
But he was in the notorious ABC Hobart mobile phone black spot. And that tweet never appeared. We watched him put the tweet into his phone and send it and show us the hashtag.
Yes.
Nerdzilla Bat Tie.
Mm. Our own little Faraday cage ate it.
And it never appeared. It obviously never left his queue. And we've asked him to retweet, but I don't know if he's paid any attention to our request yet. He's a very busy man. But we've tweeted it, and we would encourage you, if you have an answer, to go and check out our tweet about it. You just look up the hashtag of Nerdzilla Bat Tie and see if you can identify what Andrew is wearing.
Who is the comic book artist who drew the Batman featured on the tie? Because there is much debate in the office about it.
Nerdzilla in review.
Joel, last week in review, talking about the giant Paul Levitt's History of DC Comics book, I mentioned Batman the Dark Knight, the new comic, which I said was by Grant Morrison, featuring Batman in his new costume. And I can't believe not one nerd out there called me on the fact that, of course, it's being written by the wonderful David Finch, who is writing and drawing the whole comic. Grant Morrison wrote the one-shot Batman the Return, which was the first one to feature the new costume. So there you go, Bat Nerds. You've really got to be paying more attention. I did that on purpose. And now we're heading into the Wayback Machine, back to a superhero who predates Batman.
Yeah, the fandom comic's been around since 1936, so how many years does that give him on Batman?
Well, he beats Batman by 3 years, Joel.
I certainly remember the Phantom comic always being around since I was young, and it was a comic that my dad approved of. And it was really widely accepted in Australia, and I think because despite being an American comic, it's very un-American. It's not set generally in the United States, and it doesn't have, I guess, the jingoism that some American comics can have. So it's always been one. I was disappointed, you know, only a few years ago to discover that it wasn't Australian. I always thought it was.
And most Australians do. And in fact, the Phantom publishers, the Phantom creator, Lee Falk, said many a time that his character was so much more popular in Australia than anywhere else in the world. I mean, speaking of locations, I love the fact that the mythical place Bengali, where the Phantom was from, had at some points in the history of the character three different locations. I mean, it was in the subcontinent somewhere near India, then at stages it was in Africa, and for a while there it was clearly in Southeast Asia somewhere, Indonesia or something. So he just, you know, mucked around with it depending on how he felt.
Retcons it without even bothering to call it a retcon.
That's right.
Now, it's no surprise with that much history that it's been adapted for other media. It's been in books, TV shows, movies, video games, and even there's been a Phantom musical, believe it or not.
Did anybody fall and break limbs in that one?
Let's hope not. Let's hope the Spider-Man's the first one to make that star surprise. Now, I was really surprised, though, to see it on DVD in my local DVD store, A, because I'd not heard of it, and B, because it's sort of quaint, the Phantom now, and it's a masked man in a purple leotard, and it's just, there's a certain silliness about it that I never thought anyone would try. But the Sci-Fi Channel in the United States have done it as a four-hour miniseries. It was also a backdoor pilot. Basically, they put it on as a miniseries or a long movie, and if it gets enough of a rating, then they can make an ongoing TV series out of it.
So clearly, Joel, it didn't feel the love then.
No, like the Doctor Who telemovie that we're talking about with Paul McGann, it just didn't quite make the cut. And I can see why. The production values of it are pretty good, but it's the script for me. Script is just so important. It was uninspired, and therefore there's only so much an actor can do with a script that's uninspired.
Script is important. I'm going to get James Cameron in here, and he's going to beat you with a 3D stick.
Look, it's a shame because for Phantom fans, it has a huge amount to offer. It's really true to the source material and it, while offering you a sort of a modern take on it. Okay, for example, the backstory of the movie. See how much of this you recognise. A ship is attacked by pirates on the high seas. A man named Walker survives, thrown into the water to wash up on a deserted beach next to the body of his father. And over his father's funeral pyre, he swears he'll fight this evil and goes on to create this masked identity called the Phantom and a bit of a secret society to support his fight against evil. Now, his descendants carry on this tradition for centuries, fighting piracy, slavery and crime from their base in the fictional nation of Bengala. So
awesome.
It's really just like the comic, isn't it? It's so true. This movie starts off with a sort of a bit of a new bite at the cherry. The latest Walker, the young boy named Kit, he survives the murder of his parents and is adopted out. Now, he grows up with a new name, not knowing his heritage, but showing some amazing skill at parkour.
Clearly the most important superhero skill you can have.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the French superheroes, of course, have the skill of running away. The secret society, though, find him in his early 20s and invite him to join them. He refuses, but then his adoptive parents are murdered pretty much the same day, I think, by the same pirate gang that his family have been hunting down for centuries.
Shocking coincidence.
So he joins the secret society and they train him up and give him a bulletproof suit, which is not quite as daggy as the Phantom's skin-tight purple suit. It's more of a bulletproof, slightly dark nighty looking affair with a really bizarre cowl on it.
But Joel, he does look at the original suit and is offered it.
And says, no, man, it's too daggy. So they give him the bulletproof suit and some training, and then it's spy games and stunts for the next couple of hours of it. There's not really much more to tell in terms of the plot. And I wanted to like it. I really wanted to like it because it does pay respect to the legacy of the Phantom, but I just found myself bored with it. You know, most geeky films, there's something to keep me interested, special effects or action scenes or enough cute references to the original, but once I'd seen him do one scene in the Phantom suit and run around and fire people's guns out of their hands, there was just nothing left to look forward to for me. I was just bored by it. Andrew, you sat in the lounge room and watched it with me. Your thoughts?
I felt the love. I really did. Because I just think a show that goes that far to respect the source material is the reason that I like Batman the Brave and the Bold, the cartoon, because it's a radically different take on the character, but it never makes fun of him. And this never made fun of the Phantom either. It made the Phantom's island really cool. He has a group of scientists working for him. He's got a whole international network of spies and things. It was almost like a cross between James Bond. He had a Q.
More like Dick Tracy.
Yes. there was a lot of gadgets and gizmos that were pretty interesting. Look, it was plainly obvious that had this been a pilot to a TV series, it would have been episode one. It would have been cut down by about half, because I think I commented to you while we were watching it that not a lot was happening, or it was taking a long time to get to the point where you knew what was going to happen.
This was another one of my problems with it, because they put it out over 4 hours. If it was a movie and had to be done in 2 hours, it would have been sharp and a lot more interesting, but it just ran out of puff.
I love the character. I love the kid. I love the setup. I thought that, in fact, it would have been a really good series. And when you consider the efforts that have been made recently to bring back properties like the Bionic Woman series that bombed and the Flash Gordon series that was just awful, which I think was sci-fi as well, this was better than both of them, and yet it didn't go anywhere.
Look, I think it's really one for the serious Phantom fans, you know, just for spotting references out of the comics. But it's funny, it's a funny split. Phantom fans who probably tend to be older, but the other people I think it was really aimed at is the younger generation. Like, it's really clean cut. There's not much blood or gore. The Phantom has like a no killing ethic, which sort of makes it acceptable entertainment for the tweens. And there's you know, enough little bits and pieces of eye candy. All the main young characters are very good looking and everything.
With perfect hair.
Yes, with perfect hair.
And perfect teeth.
So, look, I think one for the real Phantom fans, but didn't do much for me otherwise.
If you recall, for me, I wasn't convinced up until the moment. He's got a skull cave.
Flame War on Nerdzilla.
Today we're going to be doing the great geek debate of Mac versus PC. And Andrew, I'm going to let you be first. Tell us why PCs, in your opinion, are better than Macs, starting now.
Saying that PCs are cooler than Macs is like saying that every single car in the world is cooler than a 1969 Dodge Charger. I mean, it's a ridiculous comparison. The 69 Dodge is one of the coolest cars in the world, but how can it go toe-to-toe with every other vehicle in the universe? And what does this have to do with Macs versus PCs? Let's take my perfectly normal, typical household as an example. I've got 6 computers in my house. That's quite an average number, isn't it, Joel? These machines are running variously Windows XP, Windows Vista, Puppy Linux, Ubuntu Linux, and Windows 7. Although Windows 7 is actually running on a MacBook Air, but we'll ignore that for now. The point is that a PC is whatever you want it to be. You want to run Microsoft's most popular operating system, Windows XP? Then you can. You want to run Microsoft's most dodgiest effort, Windows ME? Then you can. You can run DOS 5.1 if you can still find it. And you can run any of the 50 billion Linux distributions known to man. But a Mac is not whatever you want it to be, unless you happen to be Steve Jobs. Steve's hardware, Steve's operating system, Steve's damn cute little magic mouse. You know, it's all nicely locked down and therefore terribly boring. Oh, and speaking of boring, who wants to use an operating system that never crashes, never gets viruses, and is really intuitive to use? I mean, what's the point of being a geek if nobody's computer ever stuffs up? How do we look like miracle workers to our less tech-savvy friends? An operating system that just works and that anyone can use could spell the end of geekdom as we know it. Fancy installing a program just by copying it to the applications folder. Ridiculous. And where are the missing DLLs, the sharing violations, and my personal favourite from Linux, the kernel panic? They don't exist in Mac OS X, and we shouldn't stand for it. The PC is cooler than the Mac because I can build my own PC. But if I try to build my own Mac, Steve Jobs will sue me.
Apple is the most successful tech company on earth because Apple products are smarter, prettier, and cooler than the competition. They've set the trend for decades, from Power Macs to iMacs to iPads. Apple does it first, and other tech companies follow. Remember the first version of Windows? Disturbingly similar to the first Apple OS. And that has continued, with Microsoft always playing catch-up. Windows is still buggy and riddled with virus holes compared to the stability and security of OS X. And while a PC might be cheaper, you've got no guarantee that it'll work. Is this sound card compatible with that motherboard? Do we have drivers for the USB ports? Why do I keep getting the blue screen of death? Because you own a PC! Where Apple stuff just works. Straight out of the box. You can give your Nana a Mac. She'll be cruising the net and editing movies in a week. And they're not just for low-end users. Most professional audio and video is edited on Macs because they're faster and more stable. For coolness, let's look at the people associated with each brand. Microsoft had Bill Gates, a man so uncool that he thought Seinfeld would make him look groovy. And currently there's some sort of vat-grown Zerg podling running the show. Not much change there. While Apple has Steve Jobs, the world's slideshow champion, not to mention all the other cool Mac folk. The late Douglas Adams, Matt Groening, Tori Amos, Danny Elfman, Jeff Goldblum, and Stephen Fry. I'll finish with a few of Stephen Fry's words about the iPad. The moment you experience it in your hands, you know this is class. This is a different order of experience. The speed, the responsiveness, the smooth glide of it, the richness and detail of the display, the heft in your hand, the rightness of the actions and gestures that you employ, untutored and instinctively. Mr. Fry thinks that truly, like all Apple devices, the iPad is a thing of beauty. When did you last hear a PC being described like that?
Now, Joel, you realise using cool people who use Macs as an example that makes Macs cool is ridiculous.
Totally.
Because that's like that suggests that, I mean, there's a hell of a lot of complete f***heads driving Lamborghinis.
That was so funny, I've just pulled my headphones out. Andrew, the other problem with this debate is that you've just bought a Mac, which really torpedoes both of our arguments. Mine because we are, by definition, uncool, so nothing we own can be cool. And yours, because if PCs were so great, you would have bought one when you had the chance. And next week, we're going to actually have a look at why you made the choice to buy a Mac laptop.
I'm going to take our podcast listeners on the journey that I took when looking for a small and light computer.
This is Nerdzilla. Listen to by intelligent life forms across the interweb.
Anybody who knows me will know that I am a tragic for USB devices. I mean, ever since the universal serial bus appeared, I just thought there was a, within 3 minutes of it being invented, there was a plethora of ridiculous things that just don't need to be plugged into a USB port. And Joel, today I found the ultimate. Well, why don't you read what's written on the box?
It's a rock with a USB cable coming from it.
Now, this is the best bit about it. It doesn't do anything. It draws no power. It doesn't move. It doesn't glow. It doesn't light up. It doesn't do anything. It is a true pet rock. Can I read you from the box the product features?
Please do.
Here's why you need a USB pet rock. They make a great gift for everyone we can think of. They don't need food or water. They don't chew on your stuff. They will make you instantly cool. They will forever love you in their own rocky way. They are the greenest USB product ever created, as they draw absolutely no electricity. But this is the highlight. They are compatible with Windows 7 and lower, Mac, all OSs, Linux, and all other past, present, and future operating systems with no drivers required.
It comes packed in a box with holes in it with straw inside it, like it's really got to breathe.
To let the breathe. The cable is like, it's at least 30 centimetres long. It's fantastic. Okay, it could not be more useless and yet not more genius.
Look, I'm afraid it misses out my marks as a genius product because it fails in that most important aspect of pet rocks. It has no googly eyes, Andrew. That was what used to differentiate a pet rock from a rock.
From a normal rock.
Was the googly eyes.
But you see, I see this as just the developer going old school authentic. It's a rock. It is genuinely a rock. Oh, by the way, they're all different. everyone you get is different.
Are they actual genuine rocks? Or are they, because I thought maybe they were just a bit of plastic and they're all identical, like the rocks you hide keys in your garden.
To quote from the product features, each rock is unique. Please allow for natural variations in your USB pet rock. Come on, you got to feel the love for this one.
I can feel a certain amount of admiration for the man who thought it up, but not enough to put my hand in my pocket.
I think I have a certain amount of admiration for the person at the company that greenlit this after hearing the idea, because he's got rocks.
An ABC podcast.
Like a polite whale, I'd like to thank you for being a part of our pod today. We have had some Facebook issues. Now, we have a Facebook Nerdzilla group, but I'm being told by more and more people that no one can find it. If you put Nerdzilla into the search bar in Facebook, despite our group being public, it doesn't appear.
It's like the Phantom Skull Cave.
Exactly. It doesn't appear on Google Earth. So I'm going to have to transition us from being a Facebook group to a Facebook page. I'm so sorry about this for all those people who have been a part of our group, but I'll ask you all to transition over to the page, and hopefully in the next few days from this podcast coming out, that page will be up and around and available, and you can become a fan of the Nerdzilla page. Please bear with us in the meantime.
Look, thank goodness we have our own ABC webpage, Joel. That's abc.net.au/local/Nerdzilla, where you can find loads of extra content.
Like the Neil Gaiman interview from this podcast, we actually spent just over half an hour chatting with Neil and captured the entire thing on video. You can go and view the entire uncut interview on video right now.
We actually had to put pants on that day. You can also see a photo of my mystery Batman tie, and please help me identify who the artist was.
We've also got a Twitter feed, which does work. We're called ABC Nerdzilla. So if you'd like us to tweet in your ear, jump on and find us there.
I'll tweet that Batman artist at the hashtag NerdzillaBatTie.
That's it for now, but we'll be in your headphones again soon.
Nanu, nanu.